It's Thursday, July 12, 2016. This is the Reading Odyssey. We're discussing Ovid's Metamorphoses, books 6 through 8. All right, well, we have a lot to talk about tonight, and I don't expect we'll be able to get to every important element of these three wonderful books in Ovid. But let's start, as we always do, and end up spending most of our time discussing favorite passages. The only thing I will add in tonight's discussion is, if you like, you can comment not just on a favorite passage, but, if you will, on a favorite story, a favorite section in these three books, you know, whether it be Minerva and Arachne or Medea and Jason and the Argonauts or what have you. So let's get started. Bill, you graciously agreed to host last month when I was in Germany, and I want to thank you for handling that. And maybe you could kick us off tonight with your favorite passage, section, or story.
Okay, let's see. Well, in some, I mean, there were many, many in this. The passage, I mean, what I thought was just, what struck me the most is on page 149, which is the Athena versus Arachne contest.
Yeah.
And it's the one, yeah, it starts at the bottom where then to teach your rival by choice examples. And it's not so much the language as starting with Athena's, the story she references as a warning, and then Arachne, who's ignoring the warning, is just basically a catalog of outrage, one after another.
Exactly.
It's right. Like, and the whole book up till now has been sort of telling each of these stories, you know, with some amount of care and detail. But at this point, it's like, yeah, Ovid has just thrown up his hands and said, I'll just list them out. You know, I'll just, yeah, list out all the terrible things, or just a whole bunch of terrible things the gods have done to people.
The gods have done, yeah.
So, you know, and it's, but you do wonder that she did not learn from her countrywoman's fate to yield to the gods and not to talk big. Which, yeah, she should have known better. She should have made Arachne's weaving should have been all to the praise of Athena and what a great goddess Athena is. But who knows?
And what do you think about how Athena handled the end of that contest?
The way the gods usually handle people.
Exactly. You won, and now I'm going to kill you. Oh, I'll just turn you into a spider, since you hung yourself. Excellent.
Can I ask a question about Arachne? It says that she was a commoner, and that she had made a name for herself. What was class mobility like, and could this be like some kind of comeuppance for, you know, somebody who's too big for their britches from a class perspective as well?
Anybody want to jump in on that question?
I mean, I think that that's accurate, and more than in the first part of the book, my feeling coming away from some of the stories here is it's sort of, and I guess Ovid was warning himself too, basically it was exactly that. It's like the people who are, those who are much more powerful than you can just arbitrarily swat you down, so you have to be really careful how you interact with them. Right, which is obviously a good warning entering the imperial era.
Yes, and I think there were a couple of points in book 6 through 8 where I was reminded of Thucydides. For those of you who read Thucydides with us, there was the famous dialogue where he talks about might makes right, and you know, the powerful do what they will, the weak do what they must. And then there's also the section about the great plague that hits Athens in the early part of the war, and there's this plague section here. But this question of power, and Bill, I think you're right to point out we're entering the imperial era. And of course, Ovid has a bit of a tense relationship with Augustus there. So I think there's, my sense is that there's, you know, he's doing something here a bit underhanded in attempting to criticize, if you will. But I think in terms of class mobility, we can ask Paul Cartledge this. My non-expert sense is that there was very little of it. And the fact that she came from a humble background was more like, you know, even more, you know, to the point of, well, you're supposed to bow down and grovel. And yet she did not. And yes, you could say that she lacked humility and that was a problem, but she did win the damn contest. She did a better job than Minerva / Athena, yet that didn't seem to matter. All right. Who else? By the way, has anyone else joined us since we began?
Yeah, I'm on. No, it's Andre.
Yeah, I'm on. Sure.
Andre's on. Okay, and then who else?
Hi, Nancy.
A couple other voices. What's that? Jesse?
Nancy. Yes. I don't know.
Oh, Nancy. Okay.
And Jesse.
And Jesse.
Stuart.
Okay. Okay. Andre, Nancy, and Jesse have joined us. And there's another name there?
Yeah, Stuart.
Oh, Stuart. Oh, thank you, Stuart. Okay, great.
And Josh, Phil.
And Josh. Excellent. You were all stuck in the elevator, right? That's why you a few minutes late. All right. Andre, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
The question was asked in response to the story of Arachne and Athena about class mobility in ancient Greece. Do you have some perspective on class mobility and the lack thereof?
Well, here we have an example of a woman asserting herself. And I think women in Greek society were in a class of them, you know, of their own, not in a good way. So I think we have two, you know, we have the gender and the social class sort of double consideration. You know, the weaving was an essential part of how a woman was defined. So here's a woman who is very good at what she does. She's a traditional Greek woman in a traditional Greek role, and she still can't assert herself without being, put down by a female deity. So I don't know. You know, I mean, that's a pretty tough thing. You know.
Okay.
I mean, this is Elizabeth. I mean, I know that it's, you know, sort of set in Greece, but is Ovid that historical? I mean, he's a Roman, and so wouldn't he and his readers be thinking of Roman society?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They certainly would be.
Yeah, and if it were, if weaving and spinning was not as much of a defined female role for the Greeks, it definitely was for the Romans. So, yeah, I'm assuming it's for both cultures, but Roman women, I mean, were, you know, spinning was like their main role, was one of their best virtues is if a woman could, you know, weave and spin yarn and stuff. So, it's definitely applicable as that. I mean, now, what is he trying to say? I'm not sure. You know.
I find it interesting that he follows up that story with the story of Niobe, who has to be the stupidest woman on earth. I mean, she loses, she insults the goddess, or the god, I forget which one it was, but then, and all her sons are taken from her, and she still crows, like, ha-ha, I'm still better than you, because now I still have my seven daughters, and ha-ha-ha, and then all her daughters die.
Yeah.
And so, again, it's a woman who thought she was as good as the goddesses, and everything was taken from her.
Yeah.
What, I mean, you know, I missed the last discussion, but what is the relationship of Ovid to Greece?
Well,
was that discussed?
I don't know. I was in Germany on the last one, but I don't think we discussed that. But
we didn't talk about that last time.
But I think, you know, you're also asking the question, what is the relationship of Rome to Greece?
Yeah, right. That's right.
Right.
Okay.
And Andre, would you like to
talk
a little bit about that?
This is interesting because a lot of the myths and legends that are in this Metamorphoses, we believe were around since the Greeks. So they're not necessarily invented by the Romans or by Ovid, but a lot of them, this is their earliest written version is in Metamorphoses. So, he's just steeped in the Greek tradition. I mean, he's bringing it to us. And in some cases, this is the written origin of Pyramus and Thisbe, you know, the Romeo and Juliet thing, for instance.
Right.
And yet
right.
It goes way back to Babylon. It probably predates the Greeks, right? But it's been an oral legend up to now, you know? Or if it hasn't, we don't have the written source before Ovid. So, I think everything in there is Greek or pre-Greek, but it's told by a Roman. And so that's what we're, you know, that's what we're dealing with. It's a very interesting.
Go ahead.
Yeah. No, sorry. I want to hear what you say.
Well, the Romans had a mixed relationship to the Greeks, right? They conquered them, and they envied them. And any upper class education for men in Rome, of course, included learning Greek and learning the Greek masters, the great historians and the philosophers. And there was a sense that the Greeks had a richer and better culture than the Romans, that the Romans felt that. And of course, they imported Greek, you know, teachers, Greek ideas, Greek art, and Greek literature into their society. But they also looked down on the Greeks at the same time. It was kind of a mixed bag. The Greeks, for example, loved Homer, and so did the Romans, but they each saw the tale, for example, and the character of Odysseus in Homer's Odyssey, where the Greeks prized Odysseus's wile and ability to navigate through complex situations using tricks and the Romans looked down on that and did not like Odysseus and his moves, and they saw him as dishonest. And so there's a lot of nuance and complexity here. Does that help to fill it in for you?
Right, the Roman the traditional Roman values were very stoic, kind of conservative, and didn't approve of that trickery, you know.
Yeah. But, yeah.
Yeah.
The introduction actually goes into a lot of Ovid's background and his relationship with the Greek stories. And actually page 21, Roman numeral 21 in the introduction, kind of goes the difference between Ovid's gods and Homer's gods. And page 22, Roman numeral 22, kind of tries to explain what Ovid is going for.
Yeah.
It's criticism, so you might want to reread the introduction.
I did read it, but now it means more to me now that I've read a lot of the poems. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's great.
Good. And Brian, how he mentions the irony that's so part of Ovid and the Roman elegiac poets. So that's important, you know. That's the twist. It's the same material, but it's a Roman, you know, for this irony. So that's good.
Nancy, at the beginning of the call, I suggested that in addition to sharing favorite passages, that we could also, we could talk about sections or stories that really resonated or that you'd like to talk about. So let me call on you. Is there a passage, section, story that you would like to discuss?
Absolutely, and I hope you can hear me. I'm in transit. you can hear me. Okay, good. I don't have the book in front of me, actually. I'm sorry about that. But it actually is in the Arachne story, and I was struck by the images in the weaving. And I thought,
yes,
the way the weaving tells stories, and I was thinking about even kind of Vulcan's shield in Virgil, and the role of these other art forms in communicating a story and how that relates in a story. So it's this sort of framed storytelling that's describing a different medium of expression.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was sort of interesting. And I don't know the history of that and all, but I just found that there's so detailed, there's so much attention to Arachne's images and the story she was telling and to Athena's story as well. And
yeah,
I found that intriguing.
Yeah.
And I'm also just going to have to jump off in about 10 minutes, so I'm going to go on mute for a little while now and listen to everybody else.
Okay. Sounds good. And Nancy, I'm not sure, I know you're on mute now, if you were on the call when Bill was talking, but he said the same thing about Arachne and Athena and their weaving and the stories being told in the weaving. Now there is a word.
Oh, I heard part of him. I didn't hear that part. So I'm sorry, Phil.
No, it's actually, I like it, it's such a, there's a word that we didn't talk about that you bring up. It's a Greek word that I cannot remember.
Is it ekphrasis?
Ekphrasis, that's the word. Yeah, Andre, you want to describe what that means?
Oh yeah, it's a literary trope where in literature, within a story, there is a work of art, a tapestry, a statue, or something, a painting that's described, and Ovid, I guess, took the opportunity to do this, right, in Arachne? Is that right? With the,
yeah,
with the tapestries, yeah.
Yeah.
And
there was also an earlier version of it. Remember when we were learning the story of Phoebus Apollo and his son who took the chariot?
Oh,
there was,
yeah,
a description of the door, one of the doors in Phoebus'
home.
Yeah,
and the murals, all the walls.
And
were
the mural in that door, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
of,
yeah. And all the engravings,
yeah,
and everything. That's,
yeah,
exact. That's the... And Catullus had done this. He had used this a generation earlier. So when he describes a couch with a blanket or a tapestry set over it, and he uses, and he goes on and he describes, it's like a story within a story. So
yeah,
it's a wonderful,
yeah,
opportunity for Ovid
to
blend stories, you know, through this ekphrasis.
Ekphrasis, E-K-P-H-R-A-S-I-S, ekphrasis. There's actually a journal of ekphrastic poetry, and the rules for submission is, of course, your poem has to be about a piece of visual art.
Cool.
In case you're interested. So let's talk a little bit. It's 8:20, of course, and we have two more books to discuss, and of course we've not barely touched the surface of book six, but who would like to talk about Medea and Jason? Who would like to kick us off there?
Well, I have a question about Medea. I had always learned or, you know, been taught that Medea killed her children to get back at Jason for his unfaithfulness, but yet in Ovid, I didn't see any evidence of that.
Yeah,
did I miss
something? You know, well, you didn't miss, Ovid missed something.
Okay.
Ovid, one of the things that's challenging about Ovid's telling of the story of Medea and Jason is that he assumes a lot of prior knowledge of the reader. You know, because the Romans were steeped in these stories, so all throughout that story, there's this assumption that you know what's happening, including when Medea kills her sons or her children with Jason. At that point, I believe, let me see if I can find that passage. Do you happen to have the page number?
No, I don't.
Doesn't he say something? I'm sorry. Doesn't he say something about some mom she was, or
Yes, some mother she was in parentheses, and that and,
yeah.
And that,
that's extensive.
And that's, I
felt the same
around
way
186
about,
or something.
187, 186.
187. Yeah.
185, yeah, it's in the 180s.
Hold on just a second. Let's find the actual passage.
A mother is about line 446.
On a little anecdote, so we met someone
there you
this
go.
Weekend whose mother played Medea as an actor. And I just led to a kind of comment about how he's still here.
That's it. I happen to say I love the Medea character. We can talk about that. But so 440, however, after, this is page 187, after Jason's new bride was melted by the heat of the Colchian's poison. So what you're supposed to understand by that is that she, Medea, killed Jason's new wife. And that, by the way, that he had a new wife. There's so, there's so much assumption happening there. So what happens is Medea returns from this trip around the world where she notices all these places where various transformations occurred. And you don't know exactly how long she's been gone, but clearly it's gone long enough that Jason has taken a new bride and had children with that new bride, I believe. Certainly has the children from Medea. So it was melted by the heat of the Colchian's poisons, and the two seas on either side of the isthmus, the king's palace in flames. She drenched her sword in the blood of her sons, some mother. So that's Medea getting back at Jason for betraying her. And she does so by killing her own son. And thus avenged, escapes Jason's own vengeance and gets back on the dragons and drives away. So that's a great example, by the way, of, you know, of what we're talking about, that Ovid, especially I found in the Jason and Medea story, assumed a lot of knowledge about Jason and the Argonauts and sort of the backstory there and what happened to Jason's father and Jason's uncle and Jason himself, who was raised by a centaur, but I don't even think Ovid mentions that. And then when you get to the part where they actually, he skips a lot of the adventures that the Argonauts go through. And they land in Colchia to try to get back the Golden Fleece, and you know, then there's a lot of abridgment happening there, and I don't know if it's clear to all the readers exactly what happened when Jason finally takes up the contest and what the contests were that the king had prescribed for him to have to win the Golden Fleece. Is anyone
Yeah. Phil, the other question I had just reading this is there are a lot of references to the Golden Fleece, and that I don't understand what that is, so I would love if someone could.
Oh yeah, I think the origination of the Golden Fleece was not explained. So who's aware of that and can talk to it? Anybody?
Is this the golden
sheep?
Yeah. It's a ram, actually.
Ram? Are we talking about the Golden Fleece?
Yes, we're talking about the Golden Fleece, and Ovid does not actually tell where that originated from. He just refers to it. He doesn't give the backstory. So I'm wondering if anyone would like to walk us through the backstory for that.
Well, all I know is, you know, with Jason... he supposedly, in other versions, he is sent, he went home to claim his birthright in Greece, and then he was sent to get this fleece by the usurping king. And the fleece and the land, since this usurping king in Greece had taken over, the land had gone foul and nothing was growing. So the fleece is supposed to rejuvenate the land. So if Jason can get the fleece and bring it back, it's tied to the Grail stories with Arthur, you know, King Arthur and stuff like that. It has that redeeming power or what have you. And that's about all I really know about it. I'm not really sure why it's a ram or why it's golden, or I think there's some myth with it. Maybe it goes back to Hellespont or something. Some hero rode this ram across the Hellespont, so I'm not sure. But,
yeah.
That's all
so
I know.
Is the Yes. So the I guess we may not have enough time to go through the whole thing, but after the call today, I can send you guys a link so you can get the backstory here and the
Isn't it that his father, Jason's father, was killed by his brother, and Jason?
No,
goes,
he wasn't killed. He was exiled.
Exiled,
but, yes, and then you're in the same neighborhood, yeah.
And Jason's going to get the Golden Fleece to get back the throne.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the uncle who exiled his father says to him, "Oh, welcome back, and you can have the throne if you go get the Golden Fleece." Ha ha ha. Knowing full well that there's no way Jason could ever get the Golden Fleece, because first of all, he has to pass through the smashing rock islands, and you know, it's going to be. And once he gets there, he's going to have all these three contests, right? Where he has to deal with these bulls who breathe flames, and then he has to put a yoke on them and drive through a field and throw serpent's teeth into the field, which will actually spring up an undead army to kill him. And if he actually makes it through that, he then has to go to the dragon that's protecting the fleece and somehow subdue the dragon and get the fleece. Okay, those are the three contest that Jason has to overcome to be actually able to get the Golden Fleece and return to claim his rightful throne. So what Ovid does include in the story, though, is exactly how it was that Jason overcame successfully those three contests. And you guys know the answer to that question, right? Who helped him?
Medea,
right. And it's some of the most poignant words, I think, in Ovid is Medea's long monologue when she first meets Jason and she's trying to decide whether she should help Jason go with her heart or go with her reason. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Remember that? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Would anyone like to read some of those lines? Is this a favorite passage of anyone? Let's see. What about Adam or Jeff, Alan, Teresa? Any of you guys? Josh, Stuart?
This is my pick for the favorite passage.
What was your pick, Josh?
My pick was Philemon and Bossus.
Okay. Yeah. That's a great, we'll come back
That's
to that.
That's my favorite too. I love that one.
It's a really nice one.
It's the one redeeming story in the entire three chapters.
Did anyone like the Medea monologue? No?
This is Jeff. I thought it was fascinating. I'm looking at page 176 where she's yes, no, and it's the battle between reason and passion, and she's about midway through, so 55-ish. And he will pledge his faith beforehand with the gods as witness to our compact. Why do I fear what is perfectly safe? Let's get this going. And, and if you read your Medea, the tragedy, you know that.
Yeah.
That agreement means nothing to Jason, and she and especially, I feel like it's with the Romans and how much they love the law and honor and following through on contracts and their obsession with the law. Ovid's kind of making fun of that too, I think, just saying that, you see it throughout and. That there's this battle between stories and reason and sense and change and agreements that don't mean anything. So that was one thing that jumped out at me.
Yeah. Let me read a few lines.
I love the fact.
Oh, go ahead.
To me, it reminds me of many operas I've seen, you know, sort of like Aida, struggle between your loyalty toward, you know, toward her father or toward her lover, you know, it's a sort of repeated theme, and very powerful.
Have any of you read Shakespeare's Tempest?
Yes.
So you may not know that Shakespeare literally took the words of one of his scenes comes completely out of this monologue from a contemporary translation in English around his time. It like completely lifted it right out of the Medea monologue and put it into the Tempest.
Which is it?
I'll let you find out.
Okay. Okay. I'll read it. Right?
I just love the end of this monologue where you know she says you'd better take a good look at how big a sin you're about to commit and avoid it while you can. And as she spoke, propriety stood before her eyes, along with filial piety and modesty and love, was prepared to turn tail and defeat.
And this section, like 176, line 60, Greek women everywhere will celebrate you as his deliverer. So will I sail away and leave my sister behind, my brother, my father, my gods, the native land. Well, my father's a mean man. My land is simply barbarous. My brother's a baby, still a baby. My sister is with me all the way, and the greatest god of all is inside me, which is her grandfather is Phoebus, Apollo. I won't be leaving great things. I'll be going to great things, being called the girl who saved Jason, getting to know a better land, city famous even over here, culture, art, and a man for whom I would trade everything in the world, the son of Aeson. With him as my husband, I will be called the god's darling, and my head will touch the stars. And on she goes. And, of course, you know, we discover that that is not to be. Because despite all of her, I mean, the thing I love about the Medea story is, I mean, she's the one who did all the work. She's the one who saved Jason, got him the golden fleece. Then she made Jason's father younger. Then she killed Jason's uncle who had usurped the throne. And she sets him completely up. And then she goes on a little, you know, pleasure cruise around the world to come back only to find the guy had forgotten about her. Hello?
Well, I just didn't get why did she leave town? I mean, she got what she wanted. Why did she disappear at that point?
Well, what Ovid says is that she had to get the hell out of there fast. She had to, you know, exit stage left because she, you know, she had just killed the king and the daughters were after her. So she, you know, she she exited while things were hot and she came back expecting things to be cooled down and to take her place rightfully as the queen. Seems right to me, anyway.
But why does he say that she feigned a quarrel with Jason? What does that mean?
That was to trick the daughters of the king.
Oh.
It wasn't the treachery against Jason. It was the treachery against
the usurping king.
Yeah.
And why was she going after the king?
Because
he exiled Jason's father.
Yeah. He had exiled Jason's father, and he, you know, even though he brought back the fleece, I'm sure he was going to find another way to prevent Jason from taking the throne. Yeah.
And we don't know from history or from any other text, does Jason know that she was going to kill the father or the uncle, or that she had killed the uncle?
Jason is a mythical figure. So, I'm sorry, I don't think there was a historical Jason, but what were you asking?
Is it in the ancient stories?
Yeah.
Did Jason know that Medea was going to kill his uncle or that she had killed his uncle, or did she do this all on her own?
That is a question I do not know the answer to. I'm not sure there is an answer, but we could look. We could ask our trusty scholar Medea tells Jason. Okay, great. All right. Well, let's move on. It sounds like there was some energy for some of the other stories, and there's certainly more to talk about. I will get an answer to that. Josh, tell us about your favorite passage.
My favorite passage was part of the Philemon and Baucis. It sounds like other people probably had the same reaction. That it's a relief to finally have a normal, loving relationship that doesn't involve deception or other types of ill will.
Yeah. Take us to a page number.
Yeah, the page number of the passage is 228.
Yeah.
And this is down line 801.
Yeah.
It's really just the end here. I thought that this was a sort of a beautiful ending to it. It says, they took care of the temple for the rest of their lives until one day, old and worn out, they happened to be standing in front of the sacred steps, talking about the place and all that had happened there. When Philemon saw Baucis, and Baucis saw Philemon sprouting leaves, as the canopy grew over their faces, they cried out while they could, the same words together, goodbye, my love, just as the bark closed over their lips. That, I just thought that was a very beautiful passage.
Yeah. Yeah, I love the line, just as the bark closed over their lips.
And it wasn't a punishment, it was actually a gift that they were able to leave the world together at an old age.
Yeah. Yeah. Who else? Someone else liked this. At least one other person said they liked this passage, right?
That was me, Jesse. I mean, I loved it because it's the one story where something good happens to good people. That just doesn't seem to happen a lot in these stories.
In Ovid? No.
Yeah. Or in Greek myth in general, but you know, they were good people, and they welcomed the strangers and gave them everything they had, and they had so little, but gave them, there's this whole page dedicated to all the preparation they do with this meager, you know, pantry to try to serve the gods, and then, you know, and then they get their reward, and what they ask for is even so humble. They don't ask for, you know, riches and I also just love how it ends. I think, I don't know if someone already read these two lines, but I love the story of how they die, and then at the very end of that paragraph it says, these things were told to me by sober old men with no reason to lie. It's just sort of a comical statement there. And then the final line there, the whom the gods love are gods, adore and be adored. And, you know, it's so counter to every other story we've read so far, you know, because that statement is so not true of every other story we've read.
Right.
You know, the gods love you until you piss them off, or they're jealous of you, or you've done something better than them, or you see them naked, or they're offensive.
Or you've done nothing at all, and they've come down and raped you, and, you know, and then, yeah.
So, hey, in that regard, one observation that struck me is how much that what you feel, what you just said, is so similar to the Job story in the Bible, and how the Job story is very unlike the rest of the Bible, but very much like the stuff in Ovid.
Yeah.
Right? The sort of God, the gods. In
that
case,
is a good point.
Jehovah and Satan, but the gods sort of, for their own purposes, making this guy's life just arbitrarily murdering, keeping people out, you know, destroying, you know, killing his family, and just for no reason, just to make a point. You know, very similar to the behavior
the
of
reason.
The gods in these stories.
Well, in the Old Testament, God is very vengeful in the Old Testament, not just Job.
Well, he's vengeful, but Job is the one case where I mean, usually he's vengeful for people.
For a reason.
For a reason, for people who aren't respecting him, who disrespect him, is really, you know, that is a cause for unlimited vengeance. But Job was a holy man.
He was a good guy.
That's unusual.
Yeah, he was a good guy.
For
it
the
was about faith.
Biblical
about
God
faith.
To go after a follower like that.
Yeah.
But presumably there's some. You know, historical basis in terms of sources, the source stories that probably tie Job to some of the stories in Ovid.
Well, and I think part of what's going on, right, is this pattern that we see now several times that, you know, it's the point is not you should not need any reason at all to venerate God or the gods. And that, if you do, then there's something lacking. And that's, I think that's the, you know, when we read the Old Testament together as a reading group, we we struggled with Job, and most people who are indeed Christian or Jewish struggle with that story as well. And I think that's the lesson that's meant to be taken from it, as I understand. Not one that sits well with us in some ways in this culture.
Hi, this is Stuart. I wanted to, can you hear me?
I
was sort of struck in these chapters by the stories that were not about people offending the gods, but people offending each other. And I guess the two were the Balamala story in 6, but also that very moving, if crazy, story with Scylla.
King Minos.
Yes, and Nisus, where she falls in love with Minos and comes to him finally and does this brave thing and is utterly rejected. I found that to be very, it was very powerful. I mean, she then goes vengefully insane, but
yeah.
It was a very, it was a very powerful rejection. And here she, as she said, she's now left all alone with no place to go because her reputation is totally ruined. She can't go back to her homeland. They don't want to take her with them to Crete. And I don't know, I sort of, this was on page 208, I mean, where Minos just, he doesn't even consider it, he just rejects, he recoils from her offering, horrified at the sight of such an unprecedented act. Anyway, is she meant the same Scylla as in Scylla and Charybdis, or no, it's a different character?
I don't know, do you know, Andre?
At the end of that story, they talk about how the fact that she was changed into a feathered bird called Cirrus, but it seems like if she was actually the multi-headed monster, there would have been a reference to that in there.
Yeah, I think so. So part of the theme, I think, at least in these books, is men behaving badly, right? Jason to Medea and King Minos to...
And then there's the story of Procne and Philomela.
Yeah.
Back in book 6 again.
Right.
And I was going to bring it up earlier when we were talking about the weaving, but again, Philomela tells Procne of what's going on through a thing she's woven and has given to her because her tongue's been cut out, which that was...
Right. What a terrible story.
It was another man who... sees this woman and says, I don't care if I'm married, I want her too, so I'm going to have her too, and I'm going to lock her up, cut out her tongue. And the thing that I find that, I don't know, I don't understand as a, and I'm not a mother, so I can't say I don't understand as a mother, but all these mothers punish these bad men by killing their children. And it's not only the men's children, but their own children. And I don't understand.
I struggle with that
how the women... do that, like why that is the ultimate punishment for the man when it's also a punishment to themselves.
Yeah.
She feeds her son to her husband.
Yeah.
I mean, it basically says that the revenge is more important than mother's love, which is hard to fathom if you're a mother.
So I don't know if that's
I
doubt it's a cultural thing back then, but I just...
And maybe it's one of the only
Medea
ways they
did it,
really
Procne
hurt
did
their
it.
Husband.
Yeah, I think I took away that to kill your husband directly would be too great a violation of the... I mean, I know killing your children is bad, but I feel that a man is worth more in this scheme than a child. A man's life is worth more.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of think the opposite because... a young boy has much more to offer than an older man. Now, granted that the ages of these men are probably, they're not elderly, but...
Yeah, but you remember that many young boys didn't live to become older men, right? Like, the whole health situation is very different than the one we have today. So you're taking a shot, who knows if the children are going to live to adulthood anyway. Whereas you have
we
a powerful. Yes, yeah, so I don't think that was the thinking of the mother, but I think it's one of the only ways they could really hurt their husband, who had treated them so terribly, is to kill especially their sons, right? Which I think they saw. But the whole thing's bad. And by the way, what did you think about purple hair tuft and that being the source of the invincibility?
Samson and Delilah.
Yeah. I need some purple hair like that. No, I don't have any hair in my head. Andre, what was one of your favorite passages in these three books?
Wow. Well, I always like Baucis and Philemon. I mean, I like to teach that in class because a lot of the other selections are usually pretty, like, tragic. So
yeah.
I try to, you know, I want to put at least one story in that's a little bit, you know.
Andre, you teach this to the high school?
Only
high school?
Yeah, only certain selections, you know. Most textbooks are just... Here's an anthology of, you know, of certain stories. So never have I ever taught it like as a whole, you know, and it reads very differently when you read it as a whole, like we're doing. So
what's that been like for you to read it as a whole now, and how what has it taught you about that difference? Like what's that'd be interesting.
Well, it's just so, you know, like especially this month, you know, reading these stories, there are a lot of, I mean, there's violence from the beginning, you know, but it just seemed to get pretty intense, you know, with Philomela and Procne and Tyrius. Now, it's not just, and that's pretty bad, you know, that's very upsetting, but then he puts more, you know. So even if you're just reading that one story, for instance, it's pretty hard to take. But then there's before and after that. There's a lot of violence, and it just brings out this, this culture of
it's hard to
you know,
read.
Yeah, it is. It's very hard to read. Now, you know that there's an article about Columbia University, the freshman. There, some of them complained that this book, Metamorphoses, should have a disclaimer on it saying that it has scenes of rape and scenes of violence and such, and that it would be very disturbing to some of these young ladies and maybe men who have been sexually assaulted. And then they read this, and then they become, you know, it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, I'm just saying it's out there. It's on.
Yeah.
But look, and however you feel about that, it got me thinking, because it is a tough book, you know, nowadays, you know, there's a lot more sensitivity about these issues, and I'm not saying we shouldn't teach the book. I'm not saying we should take it off the list, but boy, it's a tough book. Now I've assigned it as summer reading for some of my students. High school
whole book?
Girls, yeah. So I'm just kind of, you know, I'm waiting to see if some of them do express some, you know, uncomfortability with it or what have you. We'll see. You know, I'll get back on that. But
Well, I think we adults are somewhat uncomfortable with it. It's not. It is. You know, this is. I mean, I think the thing that's helped me with this reading, you know. Is to kind of do a counter reading as I'm doing the reading itself. In other words, thinking about the Medea story from the point of view, like of thinking about how could we retell that story in a way that really clarifies the role that Medea has played, and maybe even changes some aspects of it. I mean, I'm not saying we need to change Ovid, but we don't have to. Stick with the stories, the way they're told, and the way that the gods treat the humans and the men treat the women. You know, that obviously is not how we need to think about things.
I think that would be particularly important with the Medea story, Phil, because, you know, they go. There are gaps in there that if you don't have a solid background in Greek and Roman mythology, you might miss. And then they get into the treachery of Medea, and you kind of think, wow, like she just kind of became unhinged. And if you don't fully grasp the first part of the story, you think quite negatively of her.
Yes.
This would be some top summer reading.
Yeah, you know, Andre, I might recommend. I don't know if you can do this, but you might send some supplemental things for them to look at, including some background on the Medea story that'll help them read that in a way that fills in some of the gaps.
Yeah.
It is a tough story to read in Ovid if you don't know, like we were just like you were just saying, who was that? That was speaking, was that Elizabeth or Teresa?
Yeah.
It does, it makes a difference to know. Yeah. I think that, I can send you a couple of links that I found that I thought were pretty good at explaining.
Yeah, I would appreciate that very much.
Yeah.
I would too, Phil. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Okay. I'll send that out. Okay. The other thing to know is, like, you know, we haven't talked about Daedalus, of course, and Icarus, nor the Minotaur. And, you know, there's a terrific painting by Bruegel. Do you guys know this painting? The Fall of Icarus?
Yeah.
It is a fantastic painting. Yeah. And there is a terrific poem about that painting, ekphrastic poetry. The poem is called... Musée des Beaux-Arts. Yes. Fantastic, fabulous poem that really adds a lot to that painting. And of course, the two of them add a lot to the story.
What's the name of that poem?
The poem is called Musée des Beaux-Arts.
Okay.
And I'm just blanking on the famous poet who wrote it. Can someone
tell me?
Auden, thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Musée des Beaux-Arts. It is a terrific poem. And I pull up a picture of an image of Bruegel's painting and pull up the text of that poem and read the poem and look at the painting.
Was this the article that you sent out earlier, Phil? Did you send an article to us about this? That was something else. Okay.
I didn't, although I could.
Maybe I read it in the New York Review of Books recently. There's
something in the New York Review of Books about Auden?
Gosh, I'm gonna have to find it now. It could have actually been quite old, and I was just revisiting something.
Somebody sent it to us. I thought it was TLS, but I'm maybe mistaken.
Huh?
No, it was Wall Street Journal. It was in the Wall Street Journal.
Oh, I did send that.
That's what I thought. You
don't remember anything anymore. Yes, I did send that. Yeah.
I was like, where did I read that then? If you didn't send it, it was just like a month ago. Okay, yeah. That was actually a wonderful piece. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yes, let's see. Thank you.
We only have a few more minutes left. We haven't heard from everyone. I haven't done the good thing here. Alan, Nan, Adam, I think possibly also Elizabeth. We don't necessarily need to get to all of you, but would anyone like to share a passage or a thought that we haven't discussed yet?
My favorite line in all three books is on page 214.
Okay, hang on. Before you read it, let's all get to that line. So we can read it with you. 214?
Yeah,
what line number is it?
323. It's just very short.
Okay.
Hang on.
I love that too.
Yeah.
I circled that one. It's such a simple statement. But so
go ahead, read it.
It sums up the whole book. Gods can get really angry.
That's the summary. Can you give us a 5-word summary of Ovid, please?
I love it.
Gods can get really angry. Amen. Yes. Done.
That really sums
okay.
it up.
What's next? Is the landmark Caesar ready yet? All right, good. Thank you. Anyone else? Adam?
My favorite passage, it's a little more, was the plague part.
Touch on that, because it's great. Did you read Thucydides, Adam, with us?
I was thinking of Thucydides' recounting of the plague as it had affected him. This is even maybe it's the benefit of prose. It's even more graphic.
Show us the page number again.
It starts on page 191 at line 570 of book 7.
Great. Why don't you read it to us?
Well, actually, where it gets into the symptoms is on page 192 of page at line 607 or something. A scarlet rash and labored breath, the tongue is rough and swollen, the mouth hangs open, dry from panting and gulping the heavy air. And patients cannot bear to be in bed or covered at all, but lie face down on the ground, which itself becomes warm rather than cooling their bodies. No one can control the disease. The physicians themselves come down with bad cases. And then the closest thing we get to bacterial transmission, the closer one is to the sick, the more faithfully he treats them, the more quickly he gets sick himself and dies. And then the debauchery that ensues from this chaos, as they lose hope, seeing that their secrets will only live, that they indulge their desires and do not care about what helps.
One of the first earliest instances of dystopian future, right?
Yeah.
Well, thank you for reading that. And one of the things that I wanted to say, sort of a little advertisement for continuing on this road many years with us into the future, is that the longer we read, part of the pleasure comes from seeing how later authors played with or used things that we've read already. In works that occurred later, right? So this is an example of, there's no way Ovid didn't read Thucydides and couldn't have been influenced by Thucydides. And you're right, it is a more graphic description, but, you know, it's such a terrible moment in the early part of that war. What happens, for those of you who haven't read Thucydides, it's actually a great tragedy. Pericles, the leader of the Athenians, decides to implement a very counterintuitive and really smart strategy, which is when the Spartans came to fight the Athenians would just pull everyone up behind the walls of Athens and not present an army to battle them in the field. Pericles said, look, our strength is at sea, not on the field, so let's just, you know, the Spartans can stomp around our orchards and do what they will, but they'll eventually get tired and go home, and we will be safe behind our walls. This was a very controversial strategy, but initially very successful. And the problem is, however, the crowding conditions in Athens led to a terrible plague where they lost 25% of their population, including almost Thucydides gets sick. He survives. And he describes this in the book, and it's this terrible moment. And some of the language that Ovid uses here is very reminiscent of Thucydides' language, and not quite the same as Shakespeare literally lifting the words out of Ovid in his play The Tempest, but close to it, right? And this kind of conversation that's happening over years, hundreds of years, indeed thousands of years, is part of the joy, I think, of tapping into these texts. So, thank you for bringing that one up. Yeah.
Jesse here, just one quick thing. If there are any King of Thrones fans or Game of Thrones fans in the audience, I couldn't help but notice the parallel to Arya in the Procne and Oh my goodness. Yeah, story when they slice up the body and feed it to Tereus.
Yeah. Any Game of Thrones fans here? I haven't watched it, but any of you?
Definitely.
Yes, and also in Coriolanus too. Similar kind of.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Who said that? Oh
yeah. Yeah, Coriolanus. That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think Andre, do we have easier reading ahead, or does the rape and violence continue?
Well, I think it's going to get a little bit little easier as far as the violence. I mean, it's still violent, but it's not this. Well, we'll see. I mean, it's more legendary and human to human. You know, this is the interesting part that I am not as familiar with. It's the last. I know we're not to the last five books yet, but we're getting there. And it transitions over to more like not just myth, but more Roman legends. But before we get there, there's still a lot of mythology and kidnapping and everything. So yeah, there's a little bit more, but also some interesting stuff, Pygmalion and so on.
And I think we're taking the month of August off, I think, right?
Yeah.
I believe we are. So I hope you're going on vacation somewhere to rest and relax and maybe have easier reading, if not from the point of view of the skill of the writer or the density of the text, perhaps the subject matter at hand. So have a good rest of your summer, and we'll see you when the leaves start to turn. And we will finish Ovid this fall.
Thanks, Bill.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Thank you so much, everybody.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye.
Wonderful.
Bye.
Okay. All right. Good night.